白いマットのジャングルに今日も嵐が吹き荒れる。ルール無用の悪党に正義のパンチをぶちかませ、行け行けタイガー、タイガーマスク。
Welcome to the Winter Palace. I'm your host, Mark Cole, editor and publisher of Odessa Steps Magazine. Today on the show, it was the return of Jeff Merrick from Roger Sportsnet and the MVSW podcast. We're going to talk about the just-begun Stanley Cup playoffs, the passing of Philadelphia Flyers owner Ed Snyder, and the passing of wrestler Blackjack Mulligan. Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoy the show.
There must be some kind of way out of here, said the Joker to the thieves. There's too much confusion, I can't get no relief.
Welcome back to the Winter Palace. It's playoff time in the National Hockey League, so to chat about Lord Frederick Stanley's Cup and other issues, it's the return of our pal from Sportsnet and the MVSW podcast, Jeff Merrick. How's it going, Jeff?
Mark Cole, how have you been, sir?
I am good. I know you're in the thick of it, as they say, between the NHL playoffs starting and the CHL playoffs underway and all sorts of things. You are one busy beaver, I would imagine.
A little bit, yeah. Doing Hockey Central at noon every day, so that's a lot of fun. And then CHL games and assorted podcast, TV, radio appearances. So it's a busy time. I mean, this is the time of the year that everyone sort of builds to, and this is the time that, you know, you have to have a very understanding family. And thankfully, my wife and kids are very understanding. You know, that my wife's husband and my kid's father isn't going to be around very much for the next couple of months. So it's all good. This is the best time of the year.
Now, we are taping this Friday afternoon, so all but one of the series so far have only played one game.
Yeah.
You really can't tell much after one game, but what have you noticed after the from just a cursory glance, because I don't get to watch as many games as I would like having a 9-to-5 job.
Right.
It seems like after one game, Dallas seems like they're firing all cylinders, and the rest of them all seem fairly even. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, Dallas, you could even make the argument, isn't firing on all cylinders because Tyler Seguin hasn't joined the mix yet. So, I mean, they're playing against a Minnesota team that has just, you know, been starched by injuries to crucial players, and the big dog himself, Zach Parise, whose injury sounds really serious. And we just hope it's nothing more than, you know, best case scenario, maybe just this year's playoffs. We hope there's nothing longer than that. I'll tell you what, the one thing that I am wishing for more than anything else, and I know it's only one game on it, I want six more games between San Jose and Los Angeles. And I want them just like that we saw on Thursday night, which I know it's only a two-day audit, but that's been the best game so far. And it's going to be tough for any other two teams to live up to that standard that San Jose and Los Angeles achieved in their opening night matchup on Thursday. And we'll see what Anaheim and Nashville bring. You know, as you mentioned, we're recording this Friday afternoon. We'll see what they bring tonight. But it's going to be tough for anyone to even come close to the greatness that we saw in the last game of the schedule on Thursday between San Jose and Los Angeles.
Now, is it fair to say, even after one game, that this is going to be the case of whoever wins that series is probably going to be beat up and perhaps easy pickings in the next round?
Somewhere along the way, if you're going to win the Stanley Cup, and I know a team like the Boston Bruins in 2011 clearly bucked that trend, but generally somewhere along the way you need an easy series. Every team will tell you that. Oh, you know, we couldn't have done it unless we swept this team in four, or unless we only went, you know, five games in this one series, because playing the seven gamers are a grind, specifically when you play seven gamers in the Western Conference. It very well may be the case that whoever comes out of LA, San Jose is banged up. I don't expect to see both rosters intact. at the end of this series, and then you maybe say to yourself, yeah, so if I'm Nashville and if I'm Anaheim, have this thing go seven. Let them beat the stuffing out of each other for 60 minutes or maybe 60 minutes plus seven times. That just plays into the hands of whoever wins between Nashville and Anaheim.
Speaking of, Anaheim was my pick to win when I did my brackets before the playoffs started. But I know on the podcast the other day, you picked Nashville to upset Anaheim.
Yeah.
So what was your thinking behind that?
Thinking behind that is, I mean, we all know about the defense, and that's, for my money, the best in the NHL. We all know about the goaltender. And since about the week before the All-Star break, when Nashville went through Western Canada and they swept, ever since then, Pekka-Rinne has been back to the old Pekka-Rinne that we all remember and admire. But the difference with Nashville this year is they have three balanced lines, three lines that can score. I know Anaheim, especially if, you know, Ricard Raquel is playing, are really deep with their forward unit. But, you know, that center battery of Ryan Johansson, Mike Ribeiro, and Mike Fisher, you know, complemented by the Philip Forsbergs and the James Neals, you know, the Cali Yarncroft, like these guys can flat out score goals. And that's the difference we see in this year's edition of Nashville. The composition is interesting of the team. All the goal scorers up front, all the high-scoring forwards are all acquired by way of trade. All the defense and goaltending is made by way of draft and development. But I just see a Nashville team that's big, that's strong, that's balanced, can score, can defend, and have an all-world netminder. That's going to be tough for Anaheim to overcome, specifically in the net, because I can see Pekka-Rinne outdoing both John Gibson and Frederik Andersen. So a tough one either way. My real answer to any prediction, Mark, is I don't know. I throw darts at these things more than anything else, but back into a corner and ask to choose, I'll take Nashville on this one.
Over in the other bracket, St. Louis beat Chicago in game one. You are high on St. Louis. I'm of the opinion that, like Washington and San Jose, I'm just not going to pick St. Louis until I see them win, because I've been burned by them years in the past. And, you know, Chicago has a lot of mileage on their tires, but they're, you know, they have the championship grit or all the other cliches that you want to give. Do you think that's probably going to be one that goes six or seven?
I think so. I know that in game one, that's the one that St. Louis had to win, because that's the game without Duncan Keith. So psychologically, if St. Louis doesn't win the game with the number one defenseman not in the lineup, then psychologically that's tough to get up for game two. And it's at home. They were outplayed by Chicago, which, if I'm St. Louis, now gives me cause for pause now that Duncan Keith is coming back for game two and his suspension is over. I just think that if St. Louis is ever going to beat Chicago in this era of hockey, this is the year to do it. Keith's out for the first game. They picked up that win, and this Blackhawks team has played a lot of hockey in the last few years, and have had to trade off a lot of key pieces at the end of every Stanley Cup run. Eventually, that has to catch up to them, and if you're Ken Hitchcock's crew, you're hoping that it's this year that it finally does.
Over in the East, I guess the big story maybe out of the first games are the Islanders beating Florida. Would you say that was a big surprise, or just it's playoff hockey, there are no surprises?
Luongo didn't play great. John Tavares was on a different planet. Jaromir Jagr was relatively invisible for Florida. And there's a lot of kids, as much as we talk about, you know, Jagr and Brian Campbell, there's still a lot of kids in that Florida Panthers team. And key kids as well. Ekblad, you know, Huberto, and Alexander Barkov being Exhibit A, B, and C. So we probably shouldn't be surprised, considering, you know, what an inspired John Tavares can do. The one thing that I take away from that first game was, man, was it sloppy. Like, that wasn't a gap control tight playoff game at all. I mean, you're sure that that's one of the things that the Jack Capuano and Gerard Gallant are addressing with his team in advance of game two tonight as they play back to back here on Friday. Sloppy hockey, which means a lot of fun. Some big mistakes, some interesting turnovers. We look at John Tavares, you know, stripping the puck away from Brian Campbell clean, curling around the Florida Panthers net. You got some bad goaltending from Roberto Alonso. Maybe we shouldn't be surprised, other than the fact that this was sloppy and these are two teams, one that hasn't been there for a long time, and the other in the Islanders is just too banged up at this point to play anything sharply, crisply, or cleanly.
Speaking of injuries, I guess it's fair to say that pretty much every team probably has some. It's just how badly are you decimated. Like you said, Minnesota has a bunch of people out, and so does Tampa. Tampa managed to win game one. Now,
yeah.
I admittedly, as a Wings fan, my season was won when they made the playoffs.
Right.
And I think whatever they do is gravy, and if it's Datsuk's last season, that's great, but I certainly, even with Tampa Bay banged up, I didn't pick them to win. Tampa won game one. Do you think Detroit can overcome them, even
yeah,
a depleted Tampa?
Yeah, I do. I mean, Tampa won game one, supposed to win game one. You're never in trouble until you lose at home. The Wings are an interesting squad. There's the emotional story of Pavel Datsyuk, and I'm with you. No one wants to see this be his last hurrah. You want to stretch out this ride as long as possible. Detroit's an interesting team in that we're really looking at two different teams. We're looking at the old guard of 40 and 13, and then we're looking at, you know, the younger, speedier Detroit Red Wings, like Dylan Larkin and Andreas Athanasiou. So we're seeing two different teams that Jeff Blashill is able to put on the ice, depending on the situation. But no, if I'm Detroit, I'm not scared yet. You know, was Kucherov outstanding? Yes, he was. Maybe the best player on the ice. How was Ben Bishop? He was great too. But the injuries to Strawman, the injuries to Stamkos, I mean, that does show up in a 7-game series. So if I'm Detroit, no panic yet. It's only game one. We played them tight. We played them close. We played them physical. Like, Detroit just pounded Tampa at every single turn, from some unexpected people too, which if you're Jeff Blashill, you're taking a lot of positivity away from. But no, if I'm Detroit, one game, their barn, we're cool, bring on game two.
Over in the other bracket, Pittsburgh beat the Rangers in game one. Is there an injury update today on Henrik Lundqvist?
The speculation is that he will play. I think a lot of people have a hard time seeing the Rangers or Henrik Lundqvist himself, you know, not playing on Saturday. I think we'll have, you know, both the starting netminders, Marc-Andre Fleury, taking over from Jeff Zatkoff. And we'll have Henrik Lundqvist back in the net, so it won't be up to Andy Ransett to try to, you know, help the New York Rangers stave off elimination against a team that's really exposing how slow and plodding this Rangers squad is, specifically the blue line. But it's no injury update yet on Henrik Lundqvist, but as if it weren't already a foregone conclusion on paper and game one, if the Rangers don't start to turn things around and don't get more opportunistic scoring, this one could be over quick one.
I assume that this series is also helped by extra off days. I assume that will help
totally.
The Rangers.
Yes, I agree completely, specifically the injury to Henrik Lundqvist. That extra day is crucial for all these guys, especially an older team like the New York Rangers.
And the last matchup in the first round is the two teams that I live closest to, stuck in the middle between, as Steelers Will would say, are the Capitals and the Flyers. Like I said, with St. Louis and San Jose, I'm not going to trust Washington, even though this really isn't your father's Washington. It's Barry Trotz's Washington. Flyers also can play the emotion card, and that was something I was going to ask you about in a couple minutes.
Yeah.
You know, on paper, this should be probably Washington in five, but we don't play them on paper, as they say.
I would not be surprised if Philly wins this series. I don't think that they will, but I wouldn't be surprised if they do. You know, one of my brackets on Sportsnet, I'm like, why not? I'll take Philly in seven just to be contrarian, but why not? Now, I know it's tougher now with Sean Couturier injured, who's one of not just their best defensive players, but also one of their best offensive players, one of the best-kept secrets around the National Hockey League. It's going to be tough, but depending on where Mason can take them, depending on how much production now you get out of that top line and how much you can limit the ability of Washington to go on the power play. That's going to be key to all of this because, as we saw on Thursday night and as we've seen all season long, now they have a legitimate two shooting option, one in Alexander Ovechkin that's always been there, the other in TJ Oshie, who can pivot and shoot as good as anybody in the game and better than most. That power play is frightening. You watch the way they move the puck around, and it should send chills up your spine. So I don't disqualify Philadelphia from winning the series. I still think there's a lot of quality hockey players and quality hockey there. It's going to be a tough play. I don't think anyone expects it to be the 2010 opening round playoffs with Washington bowing out against a much lower seeded team. Washington should win, but Giroux, Voracek, take your pick, Gostisbehere, and inspire Steve Mason. I still think the Philadelphia does have the ability to stretch, if not win this thing.
Overall, who would you say is the is there a favorite, or is everything just too balanced and you really couldn't? You can make an argument for four or five teams to win the whole thing.
You really can. This year it's jump ball more than anything else. To the point you made about Washington, show me and I'll believe. As much as they were the class of the NHL in the regular season, I'm with you. I've been false started too many times with the Washington Capitals to say this is a squad. Because I said that in 2010. When they were supposed to be the squad the last time around, and they ended up getting starched by the Montreal Canadiens in seven. I still think that it's anyone's Stanley Cup to lose. I don't see so far, again, it's early, but I don't see one team emerging as being head and shoulders above the rest of the NHL. This one, to me, still holds a lot of intrigue because, you look at the Western Conference specifically and outside of Dallas and Minnesota, would any outcome qualify as an upset? Probably not. I think you can make a case for just about every single team coming out of the opening round of the Western Conference.
Yeah, when I did my bracket challenge before the playoffs started, it was really just a crapshoot. I ended up picking Anaheim over Pittsburgh. It's not necessarily what I want. I certainly don't want to see Pittsburgh in the finals again, or the final.
There you go. Nice touch.
But yeah, I think, you could make just, anybody, almost anybody except maybe, like you said, maybe Minnesota, maybe the Rangers.
Yeah.
Wouldn't be a total surprise. So like I just said, I am in midway between Capitals country and Flyers country.
Yeah.
And Philadelphia has the emotional chip to play because Ed Snyder passed away the other day. Now, having grown up watching the Flyers, I am not a Flyers fan in any way. I was an Oilers guy, so I saw the final between them a couple times, and
87 great, wasn't it? Wasn't 87 yeah. Outstanding? That was fantastic hockey.
But talk about sort of Ed Snyder's history. Would it be fair to say he's probably one of the most important owners in the modern era?
Yes, hands down. I mean, he was. He was there when the Philadelphia Flyers joined the NHL in the 1967 expansion. He was one of the owners that helped get Gary Bettman his position in the National Hockey League as part of his pull and his sway. The great story about Ed Snyder was, here's a guy who was, not looking to buy a hockey team until he went to a New York Rangers game and saw a guy by the name of Gump Worsley play net. And fell in love with the game, and at that point decided, I want to own a hockey team. I want some this. This is what I want in my life as a sportsman and as a sports businessman. And the Philadelphia Flyers, that first post-1967 expansion team to win the Stanley Cup, they won it back-to-back years, heralding in a couple of different styles. One, the Clockwork Orange ultra-violence, and two, the very sophisticated, high-volume passing of Anatoly Tarasov. That's when Shira ushered in. So a revolutionary guy on the ice, off the ice. His charitable work is well documented. Since he passed away, even just check Twitter and look at all the people that are tweeting about the charitable things that Ed Snyder did that helped their lives, that helped kids' lives, that helped other people less fortunate, you know, all around the NHL. And I was mentioning this on a podcast the other day. I can't tell you how many players, like ex-players, you know, I'll talk to you that'll say, hey, you know what? I just got a call from Ed Snyder the other day. He's just checking in to see how I was doing. You don't get that from the Players Association. When you're done as a money-making object, they are done with you. Not so fast with Ed Snyder. I mean, every year that family would go back to Philadelphia Flyers, and Ed Snyder would be right there with them. And, you know, he would reach out and call for no other reason, just to check in, bullshit a little bit, and say, hey, how's it going? You know, thanks a lot for playing for my Philadelphia Flyers for as long as you did. I really appreciate the contributions, and it's been nice catching up with you. He was someone who was a very strong and powerfully minded businessman, and that's how he ran the Philadelphia Flyers to some extent, but he also ran it as a fan. Like, if you're a Philadelphia Flyers fan, you know that as much as you would internalize a loss, either regular season or playoffs, you knew that Ed Snyder was internalizing it even more than you were. And he wasn't shy about getting involved in deals, whether it's, you know, the poorly thought out signing of Ilya Brizgalov. I get it. Like, I know what you're thinking. You just see Tim Thomas win a Stanley Cup, and you're saying to yourself, well, we could have had Tim Thomas if he was made available. Why don't we have this goaltender? Go get me a high-end goaltender, and I don't care how much it costs. You could always tell as a Flyers fan that this guy was obsessed with that hockey team 24/7. It's a lot of owners who don't go to the game or only show up every now and then. And you say to yourself, well, he's got his other businesses he has to care about. This hockey thing is just a hobby for him. You never got that sense from Ed Snyder. You knew that no matter what he was doing, where he was doing it, at 7 o'clock, he was either going to be at the rink or in front of the television watching his Philadelphia Flyers play hockey. That to me will be the legacy of Ed Snyder.
From afar, it definitely looked like, to borrow a phrase from another popular Philadelphia institution, that like the Flyer Kool-Aid was strong, and they really did seem like a family, even if you didn't necessarily agree. But like the loyalty that he engendered from his players was always very palpable.
Dave Schultz told me a story once. This is Dave was talking about a story going back to, I want to say, 1974. So the Hockey News does this big takeout piece on Schultz. You know, he's bad for the NHL. You know, he's wrecking the league. He's a monster. You know, you get the routine, right, Mark? So Dave Schultz, like, really, more so than he would have betrayed publicly, where he was always a stern, tough guy, he really internalized a lot of this criticism. He didn't like it. And he said, he told me he was having a conversation with Fred Shiro. And he said, you know, Fred, I'm really taking this to heart, you know. And Fred's like, look, no, you know what? You know, we brought you here for a specific reason. And, you know, Mr. Snyder, you know, loves what you do for the team and loves that kind of contribution. And, you know, I wouldn't worry. I'd only worry what Mr. Snyder said. And he said, look, Mr. Snyder loves you. He said, yeah, I know, Fred, but it really gets to me. Oh, look at what the Hockey News is calling me. Everyone in the industry reads it. And Fred Shiro, in one of the great, you know, quotes from the venerable former head coach of the Philadelphia Flyers, says, Dave, listen to me here. If you don't want to be criticized, say nothing, do nothing, be nothing. And if you're going to be something, people are going to criticize you. Just get used to that. If you don't like that, then go and be a nobody. Go and be a nothing. That's not what we want here from the Philadelphia Flyers. And, you know, that's right from the top on down. No matter what a Philadelphia Flyer did, Ed Snyder always had his back. And you look at, you know, the outpouring of emotion. And listen, man, game 3 at the Wells Fargo is going to be an emotional night. Already we see the tributes before every opening game. You know, whichever organization, Tampa, whomever, pick it, want to take a moment of silence. Washington, we saw last night as well, moment of silence for Ed Snyder. It will be nothing compared to the emotional outburst that we see in Game 3 between the Washington Capitals and the Philadelphia Flyers as the home team, the home rink, the home fans get to say their thank you to Ed Snyder.
Safe to say we're going to hear Kate Smith?
You know what? It would be a nice touch, wouldn't it? And it wouldn't surprise me if a lot of the alumni are there, and it wouldn't surprise me if there's not a dry eye in the place. And that's the fans and the players alike. That's how fondly Ed Snyder was thought of. I mean, you would bring the team, and we're talking to a Philadelphia Flyer player this year. He said, yeah, it was great. You know, we got to do this California trip, and, you know, Ed Snyder had us out to his house, and he was almost, you know, we'd always call him Mr. Snyder. He always wanted to be called Ed, but we have so much respect for the guy. And he just loved being around hockey players, and he loved being around his team. And, you know, like I said earlier, his day revolved around, no matter what he was doing, what time is the puck dropping and where am I watching this game?
Yeah, I'm definitely seeing the Kate Smith-Lauren Hart combo brought back.
Wouldn't surprise me. And wasn't it a nice touch? On the weekend, in the Philadelphia, was it Islanders game, where Lauren did the God Bless America and FaceTime Mr. Snyder, the final time they got to hear that song in his rink. It was one of the beautiful moments that we saw this season in hockey.
Now, your other job, in addition to covering the Stanley Cup, is you do a lot of junior hockey and.
True.
The playoffs are going on right now. Is there a prohibitive favorite to win a Memorial Cup? Is it London? Is it somebody else?
London looks good. I mean, Niagara stunned Kingston, swept them in four games. Rouyn-Noranda, the top team in the CHL when the rankings stopped and the playoffs started. Let's not just qualify the Erie Otters, who almost went wire to wire as the top team in the entire CHL, the Brandon Wheat Kings. Are a force, and you know, then there are some of your underdogs through all of it. Look at what Regina is doing right now in the Western Hockey League. Look at what a team, I'll mention the Ice Dogs, they have to be considered an underachiever, even though there's a dozen or so players that have been drafted or signed by NHL squad. Would some consider Gatineau maybe to be an underdog for the Memorial Cup? And while Grusin doesn't think so, but some think that it's, you know, Rouyn-Noranda's Memorial Cup to lose, considering they're the top team in the CHL. I don't think there's a prohibitive favorite. I like London. I like what they've done. They've gone through these first two series. I know a couple of scares against Owen Sound, but they battled back last night against a really strong Kitchener Rangers team to win that series in four. Mitch Marner on a different plan, probably playing in the best line in all of junior hockey with Matthew Tkachuk and Christian Dvorak. I agree with you, Mark, and I'd say it's probably London, but now they've got to get through a really tough Erie Otter squad. So there's no guarantee they even make it out of the Ontario Hockey League, let alone play in the Memorial Cup.
And where is the Memorial Cup this year?
Red Deer, Alberta, right in between Edmonton and Calgary, sir.
To conclude our hockey talk, to move on, we need to always have a little bit of wrestling talk, and unfortunately, it seems like whenever we talk, is to talk obituaries. Of course,
yeah.
It's wrestling, so there are always obituaries to talk about.
Yep.
The big one, Balls Mahoney passed away the other day. I think he was only 44.
44 years
but,
old, yeah.
But the big one in the last couple of weeks is Blackjack Mulligan, the patriarch of the Wyndham Dynasty.
Yep.
Being in Toronto, you probably saw a lot of him both in the AWA in the 70s and 80s and also probably when Mid-Atlantic ran Toronto. So what do you remember about seeing Mulligan back then?
Texas Deathmatch, John Studd. I will never forget that match. And I saw him more. I mean, I saw him a little bit in the AWA Global would broadcast AWA Wrestling. A lot of matches from Winnipeg, based in Minneapolis, though. So we would see a lot of AWA at noon on Global. At 1 o'clock, we'd switch to CHCH Channel 11 out of Hamilton, and they would broadcast Maple Leaf Wrestling. And this is when Tunney and Crockett had the association and the agreement. And, you know, talent would make its way from the Mid-Atlantic territory to Toronto. And the way the structure worked at that point, if you wanted to book one Mid-Atlantic match, you had to book three matches and all be from the top. So you'd get your, you know, Tunney would put together a card, you know, fourth from the top would be the Canadian title. So it would be a combo, you know, Dino Bravo taking on the Iron Sheik or, you know, Sergeant Slaughter picking off against Angelo Mosca. But then your top two matches would be Mid-Atlantic matches. And remember, the first live event that I ever went to was headlined by a match for the Mid-Atlantic U.S. title featuring Ric Flair and Ricky Steamboat, which was, I remember walking away from that with my dad, taking the subway home and saying, like, Dad, wrestling is awesome. Here I am thinking all wrestling's like that. Little did I realize that's probably the best in-ring chemistry we've seen of any two performers in the history of the sport. But Mulligan was always up on that on those cards as well, whether it was in tag team, you know, would always see him in there in combinations with mass superstar Paul Jones, or in singles matches, and the Big John Studd matches were always the best ones. But the first time that I saw Blackjack was a Texas Death Match. I think it was second from the top. It was about 30 minutes, and it was one of the bloodiest matches that I have ever seen. Studd got great color in it, and so did Blackjack. And it was a, you know, brawl through the stands. It was a brawl down the old Maple Leaf Gardens ramp that led to the ring, which I think everybody in Toronto still misses. But I got my fill of Blackjack Mulligan. And as a kid, too, and this is all pre-internet. This is all pre-Wrestling Observer Newsletter, which I subscribed to for the longest time. But, you know, as a kid, you know, you mentioned the Wyndham family. You know, I can still remember that Pro Wrestling Illustrated magazine that I got that revealed that Barry Wyndham was the son of Blackjack Mulligan. And I still remember, like, being shocked. You know, it was like a two-month teaser. You know, Barry Wyndham talks about why you'll never hear the name Wyndham again or Barry Wyndham again. And, you know, that's when he switched from the Barry Wyndham to a Blackjack Mulligan Jr. gimmick. We got our fill of Blackjack. And it was mainly in tags, which they did a lot of in that era. But to me, the Big John Studd Texas Death Match was the one that will live for me until I, like Blackjack, are no longer sharing oxygen with everybody.
See, I came to wrestling later, like as a teenager, and it was in the middle 80s. So yeah. To me, my preferred Mulligan now is still the feud versus Kevin Sullivan in Florida, because
right.
I so love the Sullivan in Florida versus Dusty and the Wyndhams, and
yeah.
It's like even though he was slowing down at that point, you know, those were always crazy brawls, and like you said, he always juiced, and people always juiced against him because he had the big giant meat hook, giant claw.
Yep.
Yeah, it's the
funny,
kind of thing where, you know,
it's funny too, because the two that I always associate with the claw too. One is Mulligan, the other is Baron Von Raschke. If you want to go back to AWA, and even as a kid, I always think to myself, how does that work? How is that in any way, shape, or form a finishing move? How is that in any way, shape, or form devastating?
Which, of course, leads to that great skit from ECW when Stevie Richards was dressed up as Baron Von Stevie.
Yes.
And put the claw
yes.
on Joey Styles, and Joey Styles
yes.
just, like, knocked it right off. But Mulligan was one of those guys, when they did the claw, that he had such giant hands that
he
you believe that, like,
yeah.
if squeezing your head, it's, you know. But what's funny is I was watching a bunch of stuff on YouTube the other day and looking for, like, AWA stuff to watch, you know, him and Lanza. And there was a TV squash match where they were wrestling, you know, just two guys, and it was Pretty Boy Bobby Heenan, so he wasn't even the Brain yet.
Right.
And they won when Lanza put the Cobra Clutch on a guy and put him out. They didn't even use the claw.
Huh.
And then what was really funny is, like, the guy went out, and so, like, his partner comes in to try and break it up, and Mulligan, like, tosses him out of the ring. And then Mulligan put the Cobra on the guy on the other side, so they had, like, a double Cobra on him. And I don't know if I've ever seen that before.
Can you send me that link, Mark? I would love to see that. That's a YouTube link?
Yeah,
send it to me. I'd love to see that.
Yeah, I will send it.
Normally, when, and I think, you know, many of us are the same way, and you get nostalgic when someone passes away. The one thing, it's more about my schedule and my time right now, the one thing that I haven't done yet, but I soon will do, is go down the Blackjack Mulligan YouTube wormhole. now that he's passed away, I want to refresh myself with some great Black Jack Mulligan memories, because that's, I don't know if you're the same way, the moment someone passes, my first, you know, I usually go to the Wrestling Observer website to see what Dave was writing about him, and then I go to YouTube quickly to refresh some of the memories.
And that's, well, a lot of the stuff that I was watching, I mean, I had seen some of the 80s stuff when the message board I'm on did like an 80s AWA project, so I saw some of that stuff, but it's funny seeing Mulligan and Lanza as baby faces, and they were feuding with Patera and Blackwell.
Oh yeah,
and it's just weird. It's like, I know Mulligan's obviously been a face in various places and all, but like,
sure,
I never think of him in the AWA as a baby face. And then there was a match where he ended up wrestling against Heenan. It was like some kind of convoluted tag, but there was also a great, I think this was from the late 70s. It was Bruiser and Crusher versus Mulligan and Bockwinkel. And it's
Whoa.
Like, yeah, that
so
makes
hang
sense.
On, hang on.
They
so,
were both...
so Bockwinkel carried everybody then?
But you know what I mean? It's like, this makes sense in my head now, because it's like, well, they were both managed by Heenan, so they probably, you know, wrestled in six-mans all the time or whatever. But it's like Bockwinkel and Mulligan together is such an odd couple tag team, even though they're two great guys.
Yeah.
You just don't think of them together.
That's a great point. The interesting thing about Mulligan as a face is in Toronto, and again, I'm a kid, so I started going to Maple Leaf Gardens, would have been 78, 79, so I would have been 8 or 9 years old. He was always a baby face in Toronto. He was loved. Like, he really was. Like, he was, I remember when Flair first did his face turn, and even when he was a heel, he was loved at the, by the Toronto fans. You had to line up outside the Westbury Hotel waiting for autographs. But to my knowledge, I don't know that I ever saw in Toronto Black Jack Mulligan work heel. I'm pretty sure it was always the baby face.
And it's one of those things, you know, there's just probably so much of his stuff that's, like, now you have some of these Lost Crockett tapes from the 70s, so you sort of get to see him more in his prime. But it's one of those things where I would love to have been, you know, see stuff from, like, 72, 73, 74. Like, when younger Mulligan was wrestling younger Andre, like, what kind
yeah.
of hoss battles those must have been? Because he's one of the few, you know, he was always a preferred Andre opponent because he's one of the few guys that looked credible
right.
against him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and you wonder at what point he really learned how, for, you know, more for the historians than me, at what point he learned how to work as a big guy, as opposed to just, you know, work a match, you know, based on athleticism, as opposed to work a match based on this is what a big man wrestling Andre the Giant would have to do in order to beat Andre the Giant, right? Like, Brody was the best. Like, Bruiser, like, nobody worked better as a big man for me than Bruiser Brody. But I wonder at which point that light went off. And maybe it was early. I don't know. I never saw any of the early matches with Mulligan. You wonder at which point that went off for Blackjack, because I think that's a good point you bring up, Mark, too. He really was, you know, one of those big guys that worked as a big guy and didn't try to do things that a big guy wouldn't do or shouldn't do in a ring.
That's like, you know, as a kid, you know, or even as a teen, like, I didn't necessarily appreciate sort of the older Ernie Ladd when I saw him, you know, like in WWF or in Oklahoma. But, you know, there's a guy who, like, had so much psychology, and it's like, you know, by then he was getting by on doing what he had to do, but it's like, that's a guy where you wonder, how good was he, you know, like, right when he finished playing football and just became
yeah.
full-time.
And
another
so,
guy that
was so athletic, so you would buy the athleticism, right? Like, you didn't want to, it didn't have to look like a fight with Ernie, right? Like, the cat could do drop kicks, and you'd be like, all right, yeah, that's cool. I don't know that that works for a lot of the big, huge guys consistently, but for Cat, it worked, didn't it?
Yeah. Before I forget, I saw somebody mention the other day that Patterson's autobiography is coming out reasonably soon.
Right.
So you should definitely be on the lookout for that, so that I don't forget to tell you later.
Man,
yeah,
I,
somebody...
I, watched a ton of his matches in AWA. Pat Patterson and Ray Stevens, one of my favorite tag teams of all time.
And there's another guy. It's some of these guys who luckily are still around, and it's just like, you know, even if we only had stuff from the 70s that we could see, let alone all the stuff from earlier. But I know one of my friends sent me a clip that he just saw the other day that was Patterson in Australia from, I think, like the mid-60s.
Really?
And you're like, this is – yeah, there's, it's funny. There's not a lot, but occasionally, like, Australia footage pops up, and it's so – you know, like, you learn that, you know, this was such a huge territory for Jim Barnett. And,
yeah,
you know, obviously, you know, here in the – yeah, the pre-internet days, we would have no idea about any of this stuff. But, yeah, it's like you see these clips, even from the 60s, where Patterson or you know, Curtis Iaquea, and you're like, oh, it's like, you know, it's like people are spoiled so much now by having all of this stuff available that, like, we never would have dreamed of.
No, I know.
Like,
I always sound like an old man when I say, oh, back in my, we have to wait for the odd video tape to pop up and, you know, get like a really grainy video. Now, man, it's awesome being a wrestling fan. Like, I don't have enough time right now in my days to do it. But if I were, you know, younger without a family and without a career, God, would I spend so much time on the internet with wrestling matches. Listen, it would be embarrassing. I wouldn't leave the house.
I was just looking around for stuff this morning, and a link popped up for one of those WCW Japan Super Shows, you know, the early 90s. And I'm like, okay, I remember this sort of happening, but I don't really remember, like, which one or what the card was. And it's like, oh, look, first match is Liger and Ultimo Dragon. It's like, I don't remember this. I mean, they were making it sound like this is, like, the first time they ever wrestled. I don't know if that's necessarily true. But I'm just like, you know, and I'm like, in 1992, this would have been such a huge deal.
Yeah. And it would have blown your mind. Hey, send me those links, man. Make sure I want to see that Patterson stuff, too. And you got me all Jones on wrestling. So I'm supposed to be watching hockey tonight, Mark. And now you're going to get me watching, like, old 1960s Pat Patterson videos. Thanks, pal.
That's what multiple screens and tablets are for. It's like,
amen, brother. I'm with you.
I was going to say, yeah, how many games do you guys probably have on in the studio watching at the same time? Like all four?
All of them. Yeah. I mean, you have to. I mean, you only give sound, you know, to the one game. But I mean, there's no way you can't have eyes on everything. And the nice thing about, you know, working in that environment, because there's like everybody is all in the green room. You know, and you're making your notes and you're doing your prep and you're talking to your producer and planning out what you're going to do. But the moment, I mean, everyone's watching everything. So the moment anything happens, someone always catches it and you can go back and watch it. Even if that's not the big game that you're watching, or someone will notice something and you can go back and check it out. So it's a nice way to not miss anything.
Cool. Like you said earlier, you have been hosting Hockey Central at noon on 590 in Toronto and hosting some of the games. What's the podcast schedule like for the playoffs with you guys being so busy?
Yeah, I'm still working that out right now. I got to talk to Wish this weekend and figure it out. I know we're getting a lot of grief for it on the internet. I know we want to be doing more podcasts and our schedules right now are so screwy. But I mean, we're going to get back at it ASAP. I just got to work out a couple of things with Greg and my employer. Try to figure out what my hours are going to be like in the next little while. Because it's kind of, right now it's a little bit seat of my pants, the way the days go. So
are
no,
you still?
No sked yet.
Are you still doing the Sirius show?
No, I can't because I'm doing Hockey Central at noon every day. So that was 11 to 12, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday on NHL Network. So I can't do that. I've got to be live in studio at noon, 5 days a week. So something's got to give, and that was it, unfortunately.
Cool. Well, people can check you out there, and depending on where you live and or what you can do with your internet, they can see you on Sportsnet during the playoffs and then during the Memorial Cup.
Yep.
So once again, Jeff, thanks for doing the show.
My pleasure. Always a good time. And you have some homework as well. You got to send me some links, bro.
I will, as soon as I upload this and put it all together, I will be sending those along.
Send it along, my friend. And thanks for the intros. Keep them coming. You're a genius that way, sir.
I finally got around to listening to the show the other day, and I had an idea for one when I was in the car. So there may be one coming. There may be one coming for the next time you guys do the show. It's funny. My brain was so warped. It was like I thought I had picked one out, and then I got home and I went to look for the song, and I had the title of the song wrong, and so it doesn't work anymore. Because I'll tell you what it was. You talked about how San Jose was the bearded lady that you were picking in the playoffs because Greg obviously wasn't going to pick them because of what happened before.
That's right.
And I was like, oh, great. I said, I can do an intro based on Groucho Marx singing Lydia.
Oh, that's awesome.
And then I got home and then I called it up and I was like, oh, it's Lydia the tattooed lady,
not
the bearded lady. And I was like, crap. But there's another one from Monday's show that I think I can use. So probably I will put that together over the weekend and send it off to you guys. So maybe the next time you have a show, it'll be ready for you.
I look forward to it, sir.
Thanks, and we'll talk to everybody next time.
Oh, Lydia, oh, Lydia, say, have you met Lydia? Lydia the tattooed lady. When she stands, the world grows littler. When she sits on Hitler. Lydia, oh Lydia, that encyclopedia. Oh Lydia, the queen of them all.